Clerk will call the second case, please.
The court will now call Ronnie Odoms Jr. versus the State of Texas. May it please the court, Justin E. Minnich will argue for the appellant. Jonathan Elvey will argue for the state.
May it please the court. Justice, I represent Mr. Ronnie Jerron Odoms Jr. The factual basis is largely undisputed. Mr. Odoms, in fact, testified on his own behalf, and it largely revolves around an incident, and while Mr. Odoms, who had been pretty much continuously incarcerated since he was 13 years old, was brought to the Wichita County Jail, was held there for a number of months to await hearings or trial on an offense committed at the All Red prison unit outside of Wichita Falls, Texas. While he was there, essentially one evening, and it's outlined in the brief and in a bit of a longer statement, but Mr. Odoms was able to escape from, I may not use that term in the legal sense, but to leave the confines of his cell through a pipe chase and kind of in a Mission Impossible-esque style, run around and climb through the annex. And it's somewhat important to note that the jail facility is a kind of converted warehouse that really isn't probably suitable for holding folks in Wichita County. He rips out some wires and then, using some nails attached to his hand that he had taken from his cell, he proceeds to attack or attempt to attack multiple people. Five counts resulted out of this particular event. Count one is an aggravated assault on a public servant, for which he was found guilty and sentenced to 75 years. Count two is an aggravated assault on a public servant, for which he was found guilty of a lesser-included offense of attempted aggravated assault. We'll discuss that in a moment. He was found not guilty of the third count of attempted aggravated assault of a public servant. And he was found guilty on counts four and five for escape and possession of a deadly weapon in a penal institution. There were three points of error that are brought before the court today. The first of those is that Mr. Odoms, throughout the duration of his trial, was shackled, both hands and feet, and was then attached to a steel plate that was placed on the floor in each of the two courtrooms that were used.
Is there any evidence that the jury observed the shackles?
And that's, I think, the major issue that we'll get into. I don't believe that there is any in the trial record.
And is it true that a black cloth was placed around the edge of the table so that the shackles were obscured?
In the record, there are some several mitigating actions that were taken, ordered by the court. One was a black curtain kind of draped around the bottom of the table. Another was that there was an instruction essentially to the sheriff's officers to make sure that there were no jurors present when he was being moved in or out. And the court actually did quite well with that, even when we placed him up on the stand and through some other actions. Those were relatively well mitigated. If I may, that's kind of the second part, and I'll kind of skip ahead. Essentially, there is no findings by the court. There's some evidence presented, one by a jail captain. There's no evidence of violence or escape that comports with any of the case law or anything specific there. He essentially says these are offenses that he's currently in jail for. We've had some trouble with him. He doesn't go into what those incidences are. He doesn't talk about the use of force and specifically what was required security-wise in the jail with Mr. Odoms. I think it's important later in the record we hear from one of the detention officers, which actually tells us that they consider merely not cooperating or not doing anything in response to a request can be considered an aggressive action. I think that's somewhat telling when they're saying, and that is something that requires them to take a higher use of force. So when Derek Metter discusses on the record that force was used at times, there's no real background of was that actually necessary, what was the basis for those. Starla Jones was...
Let's just say, for argument's sake, that there was not enough evidence for the trial court to order the use of the shackles.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have any authority that is reversible error without any evidence of harm?
And I think that that's probably the more important part. So we'll move to that because it's clear that there is there is no findings by the court, and that really this hinges primarily on the fact that what is required by the defense to show error. Because of the constitutional implications in the shackling, of course, that there would be some, there would be the duty by the state to show that it was beyond a reasonable doubt that the error complained of did not contribute to the verdict obtained. But in both Cooks v. State and recently cited in a court, in a case that I imagine that the state will bring you in Velez v. State, it's an unpublished CCA opinion, it puts the onus on the appellant to show that the jury saw the shackles. I would argue that that's in some contradiction to Missouri v. Deck, in which the Supreme Court found that shackling was inherently prejudicial. It becomes difficult when you have a requirement of the defendant himself that has him choose between his right, and I'll note that it's not only the presumption of innocence that's part of the shackling, it also brings into right to counsel issues and due process of law issues. In both of those, when you have particularly with the right to counsel issue, Mr. Odoms is unable to write notes to address his counsel. He's unable to, essentially he's required to, at that point, choose between his rights of presumption of innocence and his rights to his right to confer with his counsel. And I think that when we would look at the requirements for the defense at that point to bring that forward, it would be nearly impossible. I know where I would end up if I stood up every time Mr. Odoms had raised his hands, or that we heard a clinking on the metal plate. I don't think that it's possible to raise an objection every time to present that to the record. I think that a motion for a new trial would be the appropriate place to do that. In this case, the motion for a new trial, which is requested to bring forth particularly right to counsel issues, which concerns both the right to confer in the second point of error and the shackling in the first point of error, was overruled by operation of law after 75 days. I think that it would be most appropriate in this case, I think it hinges on that, that the case be sent back specifically on that issue to the trial court for testimony regarding the ability to have that hearing and show, in fact, you know, that there were numerous, almost continual times where the jury would have seen at least the arm shackles. In this case, it wasn't just the legs and the floor, it was handcuffs as well. Moving on to the second point of error, it's the right to confer with counsel. It's in volume three. My statements are on objections on page 16. The preceding pages before that include some of the testimony of jail captain Donnie Johns. At that point, the jail captain did testify that there are two jailers required to be present at all times between meetings between appellant and myself, his attorney, trial attorney at that time. In the hallway, next to me, and sometimes farther away. That particular room is probably about, it's not a large hallway, it's an interior hallway. Essentially a small room, kind of between the pillars almost, maybe 5 feet wide. So it's not a private area with which Mr. Odoms can discuss case strategy, in which I can prepare him properly for the exercise of his rights. In pretrial hearings, there was an objection that was made. Essentially, and you can see this starting on page 16, volume 3, that I explained the situation to the judge, sought the guidance of the court at that time, and noted that it was impossible for me to know exactly what information I was not receiving, and implicated my client's Sixth Amendment right at that time. I noted that that the restriction on the visitation was the specific reason that we were concerned. The statement that you'll see in the state's brief.
What relief you were asking for, and you said you weren't asking for any relief?
And that's exactly what I'd see. The state quotes me with the statement, I haven't really asked for relief at this time, and that's underlined in the state's brief. But I think what's most important is to continue on that. Other than the opportunity to meet in the future with Mr. Odoms privately, and to lay the objection before the court for the previous incident, which at that time I had advised the court was that I'm not getting adequate access to my client at this time, and it's specifically because sheriff's officers are required to be with us, that there's no private ability to counsel.
Did you renew that objection at any point in the future then when you were asking for private conference with your client?
There was not a renewed objection at that time. The judge at the end of this statement makes a ruling essentially that he defers that to the essentially denies the objection, overrules, and then says that the sheriff will do what the sheriff wants, that they're control of security, and that's what's going to happen. And that was an objection to, you know, to as we were proceeding through the court. I think that initial objection and denial carries through for the rest of the trial. There had been no change to that status, and the judge made a specific ruling to that objection at that time by determining that it would go as it had been at the sheriff's discretion.
I read on my interpretation of reading on page 8 of the state's brief was that you indicated you appreciated the presence of the officers for your own sake. I misread that?
I could see how you're saying. I think that may be a bit out of context. What I was simply saying was not that I actually wanted them there, but that I was simply saying I understand why they might have them there initially.
For you?
For me, certainly, or for anyone. And there, you know, there had been some evidence that he could potentially have a weapon, or that, you know, any number of things. I've been in contact with him multiple times. I've never found any issue with being present with him. I didn't feel the need to have that security required. And that was essentially a nicety, I suppose, to the jail captain, saying that I understand why you would do this, but it doesn't comport with my client's rights. We need to have the ability to have that in a private manner. It is a constitutional right that the court essentially overruled and then abrogated its own discretion over to the sheriff's department.
Are we drawing a line between prohibiting someone from speaking to their counsel versus you just don't like the circumstances under which you were able to speak to your counsel? He was able to speak to his counsel.
Certainly. I think that if we look at a Fifth Circuit case, Taylor v. Sterrett, which is 532 Fed Second 462, it's actually a case regarding jail mail. And it primarily says that, you know, any infringement on reading that mail and not having basically private conversations is an infringement not only on the right to counsel, but additionally on the right to access to the courts. So I think that it's not just whether, how you would prefer it, Your Honor, but I think he has an absolute right. If we look at Oklahoma v. Cooper, United States Supreme Court's 517 U.S. 348, that case essentially notes that the requirement to have that counsel is completely is necessary in that I have to give him the advice necessary for him to exercise his rights, particularly Fifth Amendment rights, appropriately. He was not given that opportunity in this case. It was clearly notified to the court, and simply having an attorney, but one that you cannot talk to, does not provide
To under the circumstances that you wish.
One more time, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
Not being able to talk to him under the circumstances that would be preferable for you.
Well, and I would distinguish it again from being preferable. I think that there's a way in which, you could set up a safe and secure situation that doesn't have two law enforcement officers. And I've noted it in the brief, the alleged victims in this offense are Sheriff's Department detention officers. The people viewing, may I finish one?
Yes.
The people that are listening into the conversation are Sheriff's Department detention officers. There's no way to have a full and fair discussion. There's no way to have adequate advice and of counsel under that condition.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Elzey, and along with Stephen Rancourt, we're here on behalf of Wichita County. The judgment of the trial court should be affirmed for three reasons. First, the judge made a finding of manifest necessity for shackling the defendant hearing on the record and having facts that supported his decision there. And secondly, the appellant can show no harm from that shackling. Secondly, the appellant failed to preserve error with regards to his claim of inability to communicate with his attorney. And finally, any error with regards to issue three from the judge's failure to grant a directed verdict is moot based upon what happened later. First of all, the judge did make a finding of manifest necessity for shackling the defendant, and this came after he held a hearing and received evidence as to whether or not the defendant needed to be shackled. He heard testimony that just before the pretrial hearing, this appellant had told detention officers he was not suicidal, but he was homicidal. That's a clear threat to all those who are going to be involved in this process, whether the detention officers, judge, court personnel, or jurors. This is a person who's on trial for attacking jailers, for escaping from his cell and attacking detention officers while he's in custody. He heard evidence from an investigator from the prison who testified that there were cases pending for this defendant while in prison having weapons in his cell and in his possession and attacking prison officers with those same weapons. The record is clear that this was a dangerous man, and the prison investigator said, if you don't have him under control, then under some type of control, then he's unpredictable and he's dangerous. The Wichita County jail officials also said he is unpredictable with regards to his behavior. Based on what his own behavior, his words, right up to trial, he showed that there was a need to have some sort of control and shackling for him. And the judge made that finding a manifest necessity immediately after hearing this, and I think that record supports that finding. But even then, the appellant can show no harm from that shackling. The case law is very clear that the jury has to have seen the shackles or been aware of the shackles to show any type of harm. There was a table skirt, as already been discussed, and Mr. Nims spoke about the transportation of the appellant. Further, the judge said that when the jury came in or exited or the courtroom was cleared, all the parties would be seated, that no one would move, and so that way no one would be aware of those shackles and no one would know about it. The record contains statements by the judge that these shackles can't be seen by the prosecutor. And even the appellant's own counsel in the reporter's record, volume 3 on page 21, said, we can't see these shackles. It's clear from the record that they could not be seen. There's nothing to show that. The Court of Criminal Appeals has been clear that unless there's evidence that the jury actually saw the shackles, there is no harm. In 1991, in the Long case, which we cited in our brief, the court held that the judge there made a general finding that for the safety and security based on the offense charge, that the appellant or defendant in that case should be shackled. However, the record contained no statements that the jury actually saw the shackles, so there was no harm. I note for you there that the only measures taken to keep the jury from seeing the shackles in the Long case was the attorneys placing their briefcases in front of the tables so that the jurors would not see the shackles. Again, the next year in the Cooks case, which we also cite, the court said there the issue is whether there was error in permitting the shackling in the absence of evidence that the appellant was a security threat. I would distinguish that case by saying that there is evidence in this record that this appellant was actually a security threat. And the court went on to say that absent evidence that the jury actually saw the shackles, we will not conclude that the defendant has been harmed. There again, there was no evidence in that record that the jury actually observed the appellant in shackles, just evidence that the shackles were not visible. In the absence of any evidence, they say in that case, in the record indicating that the appellants were actually seen by the jury, we conclude that the appellant was not harmed. They also talk in the appellant's brief, he says, well, I can't note every time the jury may have seen the or heard the shackles. Well, in the Cook's case, in a footnote, they mention, have a post-trial hearing, have affidavits from the jurors, bring them in to testify and say whether or not they saw or aware of the shackles and how that influenced their decision-making. That was not done here, and so there's no evidence in this record to let us know whether or not the jury saw the shackles. All we can assume is they weren't seen, and so there is no harm. Also, Mr. Nims cited the Velez case. We provided that to him yesterday. It was released in June of this year by the Court of Criminal Appeals. Its cause number is AP76051. It can be found at 2012 Tex Crim App, Unpub, Lexus 607. And it is an unpublished decision. However, in that case, the judge made a decision to shackle the defendant. And all that's shown on the record is the defense attorney said, Judge, my client's in these shackles, can we have them removed? The judge's response was, no, sir. That's all that's there. The court said that was an abuse of discretion by that trial judge. But because there's nothing in that record to show that the appellant was, or the defendant in that case, was seen by the jury in shackles, there's no harm. The court, quote in that case, says he fails to direct our attention to any place in the record showing that the jury actually saw the shackles. And they quote the Cook's case again. Absent evidence that the jury actually saw the shackles, we will not conclude that the defendant has been harmed. I think it's quite clear that the court, through its progeny, has seen if there's no evidence in the record that the jury saw the shackles, there is no harm, and that's the situation we're in here. There is no evidence in the record. The only evidence in the record is to the other side to show that the shackles were not seen, so there cannot be harm. We did mention the Bell case in our brief. That case, the Court of Criminal Appeals has granted PDR on, and I want to distinguish that from the situation here. In that case, there's two issues. The first issue is that you have a trial judge who has a systematic and continuous practice of shackling every defendant in his court who cannot make bail. That is not the situation we're in here. This is a one-time situation based on exceptional circumstances based on this defendant's behavior. And that's clear in our record. The judge makes numerous comments to that regards. Second, the court is looking at, the appellant in that case has said that the petitioner should not have the burden to show that the shackles were not seen by the jury. And that goes in direct conflict with the current case law. The current state of the case law is that it's the appellant's burden to show that the shackles were not seen. But even then, even if the court were to flip that and place the burden on the state, again, the record is clear that they weren't seen, even by the statements of the defendant's own attorney at trial saying, we can't see these chains. And again, it's also distinguishable from the Deck case. Deck is where a court, without adequate justification, orders the defendant to wear shackles that will be seen by the jury. That's the issue in Deck. We're not in that situation here. Here the shackles were not seen. So because they were not seen, there is no harm. The second issue that's been raised is that the appellant did not have adequate communication with his attorney. The rules of appellate procedure are quite clear that the judge has to be made aware of the error, neither rule on or refuse to rule on the error. I don't think it was clear in this record that the appellant's attorney was making any type of objection. He asked for no relief. When directly asked, he said, I'm not asking for relief at this time. When it's not clear in the record as to whether an objection was made, we have to look at the context it was made into. He asked for future visits with his client. I think that the behavior of the judge, as well as the other counsel in the case, shows that they all thought it was a request for prospective relief. In the reporter's record, volume 3, on page 23 and 24, it's directly after this conversation with the judge. The state's counsel notes that she's spoken with the sheriff's office. They had agreed to allow counsel into the cell for privacy with his defendant. As long as they submitted to a search, they could go into the cell and be in there alone away from the detention officers. Nothing in the record shows whether or not the appellant actually took advantage of that, but that option was given to him to have completely private conversations with the appellant in his cell away from detention officers. So based on the context, we believe it was a request for prospective relief, and based on what was asked, that was given to him. He made no showing of harm. There's nothing in the record to show what may have been stifled, and we believe the appellant has to show some type of harm from this. And all we can see is that nothing was preserved because the judge wasn't aware of what was being asked for, and that when he did ask for prospective relief, that was given in arranged form. It's just not clear whether or not he took advantage of that. With regards to the third issue, the appellant, there is no harm from the judge's denial of the motion for directed verdict because the defendant was not actually convicted of that count of aggravated assault on a public servant, but of a lesser attempted assault on a public servant. That count was for aggravated assault on a public servant, and the issue in that motion for directed verdict is the defendant claimed there was no evidence of bodily injury. The judge denied that, but the jury came back and found him not guilty of that count, and instead convicted him of this lesser included count of attempted aggravated assault on a public servant. The element of bodily injury was not included in that count of attempted assault. So there is no harm here because he was not convicted of what's being complained of. Further, even if the judge had granted that directed verdict, the state would still be entitled to submit that attempted assault to the jury in the jury charge. And the appellant is not complaining in this case about the legal sufficiency of the evidence with regards to the attempted offense, and he's not complaining about the submission of it to the jury. So this is a moot point. The defendant was not convicted of that, and any harm is not there because he was not convicted of that, and the state would have been entitled to present this anyways. Because the record contains reasons for the judge's finding of manifest necessity to shackle the defendant, and because the appellant can show no harm, because the record contains no references to the jury actually seeing the appellant in shackles, there is no harm, and issue number one should be overruled. Issue two should be overruled because the appellant failed to preserve any type of error, and he was granted whatever prospective relief, which is what the context seems to indicate he was done. So there is no error there, and that should also be overruled. Issue three should be overruled because it's moot, since the defendant was not actually convicted of that count, but of a lesser included attempted count, and there's no challenge to the submission of that or the sufficiency of the evidence there. For these reasons, the judgment of the trial court should be affirmed. Thank you.
Mr. Nims, rebuttal.
It's clear that the trial court abused its discretion in shackling defendant. The Long case, again cited by Velez recently, lets us note the record must clearly and affirmatively reflect the trial court's reasoning. That wasn't done here. All that was stated on the record by the judge was, I find manifest need. That's not enough. The only real issue is whether the burden has been met to show harm. I would side with the court in Deck that it's inherently prejudicial to object every time. Would again, under the Texas rules, would essentially put the onus again on the defendant. To object every single time would bring the pace of trial simply to a crawl. It would draw even more attention to the harm that the court and that the state has imposed upon my client improperly. If the decision in this case comes to what the record shows of what the jury could have seen, would have seen, it would be appropriate to remand this case to the trial court for a hearing in which the appellant could introduce testimony as requested in his motion for new trial that would clear the issue. While I certainly concede that there's no evidence on the record that shows that the shackles were seen by the jury, there is one statement that at one single point they were not present. However, it's essentially farcical to claim that factually that the jury never saw them. So I think it would be appropriate at this time to allow us to have the hearing and to present that evidence to the court. Regarding the second issue before the court today, I haven't really asked for relief at this time other than, and that's the request, that's the objection, other than the opportunity to meet in the future with Mr. Odoms privately and to lay the objection before the court for the previous incidents.
Don't you have to object and ask for relief?
I believe that we did ask for relief, and the court clearly understood that we were asking for relief, and the fact that he denied that objection and said that he would not grant relief. I think that statement on page 16, and it's a bit rambling, is essentially a request. We've made the judge aware we have not been able to see, that I have not been able to see my client, that it is we feel it's a violation of the Sixth Amendment, and that we want to have a right to confer between attorney and client at that time.
Was it at that same hearing that this offer that opposing counsel went into and his argument was made?
There is an offer. It's not one that the judge rules on. It's one that's simply from the district attorney. There's a word that's left out there. It's not if the appellant's counsel would submit to a search. It would be if appellant's counsel commits or submits himself to a strip search. It's essentially a threat against appellant's counsel. It's another attempt to essentially keep counsel from the appellant at that time. I think that actually sides more with our argument at that time, that the state was essentially keeping counsel from Mr. Odoms. In Getters versus U.S., the U.S. Supreme Court found that it was inappropriate and that error was there in not allowing an attorney to meet for one overnight visit with his client over a 17-hour period. This was throughout the rest of trial, that we simply could not have communication. It's inappropriate. On the final issue, again, these are the comrades, the workmates of the people that are actually listening to. This is the victim's family that's sitting next to us while I'm having a conversation with my client. And that certainly, it necessarily creates that taint that the state claims would not be present in its brief. And I'd refer the court again to Oklahoma v. Cooper. On the third issue, if you essentially rule in favor of the state on the issue, the court would be sanctioning prosecutors to essentially upcharge every offense. I think that there's a public policy issue that there should be, it would not be an appropriate use of judicial discretion if we simply allow completely non-factual charges to be presented to the jury. It should have been dismissed at the motion for directed verdict should have been applied at that time, and we'd request that the court rule and remand the case on the first issue. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for driving here from Wichita Falls. Have a safe trip home. We appreciate you being here, and your case is submitted.